And now, with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved, here is Dr. James Hauk.
Good evening, everybody, wherever you are in the world at this time. Welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, reclaiming that which has always been in you. Very excited to be with you here every other Wednesday evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. I'm Dr. James Hauk, and if you would like more information about me, or if you would like to leave me your comments about today's show, I invite you to visit the website. It's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. That's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. And if you would like to be part of the show, I invite you to call in. I'll be taking your calls after the break. That number is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And each and every week, as you know, these shows focus on the integration of our psychology and our spirituality, our mental health and our spirituality, in order to show just how intertwined the two disciplines are. And as I said, I'll be taking your calls in a little while because I really want to hear your heart, shall we say, on today's subject. Where did Kansas go, Dorothy? So happy that you decided to spend this hour with me tonight. And just in case you cannot spend the whole hour with me, I just want to remind you that these broadcasts are also podcasted. In case you want to go back and listen again, or you go back into the archives to listen to previous shows, just go on the website and then just click on Reclaiming Authenticity, and you'll pull up to that particular page, and then scroll down a little bit, then you'll see where the archives are, where they begin, and you can find the show that you would like to listen to. All right. Well, for those of you who are new to the program, and I know that people are tuning in new all the time, I would just like to say that personally, I'm a firm believer that all of us come into the world already equipped and graced with everything we need for in this life in terms of our giftedness, our skills, our talents, our strengths, our character traits, personalities, so on and so forth. And yet, sometimes we go along in life and due to some unpleasant experiences, we may doubt whether or not we have everything we need for in this life. Depending on what those unpleasant experiences are, you know, at some point in our lives, we may have pushed our giftedness way down so that others cannot see it. Because perhaps we went through something and our talents or our skills were downplayed by others, or perhaps they ridiculed or caused us to think less of our giftedness. And so we just ended up hiding that giftedness away in order to protect ourselves from further wounding. Or maybe at some point growing up, or even today, you were told that you would never amount to anything, or whatever other voice we heard telling us that there's nothing special to us. That is simply not the case. Because when we do not realize our giftedness, when we do not embrace the uniqueness to us, we go through life functioning from that place of woundedness instead of a place of healing and wholeness and hachetas, uniqueness, or a thisness, so to speak. And everybody has a thisness. You know, as you said, two people can do the exact same job, but nobody can do it quite identical to each other, because you're going to do a certain job or have a certain skill according to your thisness, and I'm going to have, you know, performed a job or a skill according to my thisness. It's kind of like our own personal stamp on things that we do and who we are. In fact, there is so much more to us than what we have become so far. And that's what reclaiming authenticity is all about, helping you find the courage to reclaim that which has always been in you, those things which you have brought into this world. So it is indeed my great pleasure to be with you here tonight. I hope that wherever you are today, throughout this day, you are safe and you are at peace. And how is your heart today? How is your brain? How is your courage? How is your self? Well, I'm sure you would agree with me that one of the classic ways to teach us the deeper meanings of life is to tell a story and use the metaphor or the analogy of taking a trip, a journey. And this could be anything from, say, the Wizard of Oz to National Lampoon's Vacation and everything in between. But, you know, all trips begin at the same psychological and emotional place. Well, one of my all-time favorite stories comes from the book The Alchemist. You've heard me talk about this many times on this broadcast. And this is where Santiago, a little shepherd boy, he starts off for an adventure to seek his own personal legend, which, of course, leads him to the pyramids of Egypt. And I won't give it away in case you've never read The Alchemist. And so, you know, I just want to say that, yes, all stories that involve going on a journey begin with that same anticipation of engaging the unknown. You know, we often anticipate what the trip will look like, you know, and we may have many assumptions that have stapled themselves along the way. How the trip is supposed to unfold, how long is it going to take, what are we going to find when we get there, so on and so forth. You know, that's just part of being human. I'm convinced of it. And yet, only after we have arrived at the end, so to speak, can we look back and realize how different we are from what we have been or where we have been. In other words, something happened to us along the way. Our outlook on life has changed. Our values take on a deeper significance, and we're never going to be the same. So, yeah, where did Kansas go, Dorothy? Or I should say, as the author poet T.S. Eliot summed up quite nicely, he says, "We shall not cease from exploration, and at the end of all of our exploring, will be to arrive where we started and know that place for the very first time." And indeed, a transformation has taken place in us that allows us to see ourselves and our experiences with, let's say, a fresh set of heart lenses. Now, there's a condition here. You know, this transformation can take place if we are open, teachable, and malleable to greater things. You know, this phenomenon even occurs when we've read a passage or a book many, many times, or if we've watched a favorite movie many times. You know, we've all been there. All of a sudden, something new catches our attention, or it jumps out at us to where we never quite saw or heard that said or put or whatever before. And as a result, all things become clearer. Even within the context of experiencing, say, traumatic events in our lives, our worlds are often turned upside down, and we try to make sense out of just what happened. Where did Kansas go? Well, over the years, the treatment for PTSD often involves telling a story, our story, from the point of view of taking a journey. This was my life before. This is what happened to me, and I'm not quite sure how this is going to unfold. I don't know where this is going to lead, and so on and so forth. But, you know, regardless of the various mental health treatments used to treat PTSD, the desired outcome from the traumatic event remains the same. We all strive to reconnect to what was lost. We want to go back to the way things were before, you know, that traumatic event. We want to go back to simpler times, or a time when we didn't feel the pain, or a time when we didn't lose, you know, precious loved ones to us. We want that reconnection. And of course, personal safety is still the primary concern for any traumatized person. You know, as triggers have always, you know, they have this potential to create unsafe conditions. And in fact, a traumatized person may seek professional help in alleviating, you know, say the above symptoms. But yet, in conjunction with personal safety, is this overall treatment goal of helping the person reconnect with his or her personal relationships. But yet, there's a caution here. There's a little caveat here. Reconnecting interpersonal relationships by examining personal assumptions about a sense of control and power in our lives, as well as healing interpersonal relationships in which issues of trust and safety and self-esteem, etc., may have been shattered. These tasks may be especially difficult if the person has, you know, defined themselves by the trauma. And add to this phenomenon, you know, that in intergenerational trauma, what has been handed down has not only been the traumatic symptoms, but also there's this distortion of how people view themselves in light of what has happened to, let's say, the original generation in which the trauma was experienced. Now, this debate of how trauma and the effects is transmitted from one relationship to another or one generation for another has really dominated the studies of intergenerational trauma for some time. And interestingly, the transmission of intergenerational trauma is still an ongoing conversation generated by people who understand that, you know, this trauma transmission, as it were, they see this from either a nature or nurture viewpoint. Because on one hand, from the nature viewpoint, beliefs center on trauma as being contained and handed down through our genes, the DNA, let's say from great-great-grandparents and down to the great-grandparents and down to the grandparents and down to the parents and then down to the children, like so on and so forth, okay? But the nurture side of this argument certainly believes that trauma is passed down by the way or through the way we were raised or how we are being raised, you know, our attachments with our caregivers, as well as how we develop relationships throughout our lives. Now, to be quite honest, both sides present convincing examples of this transmission of trauma, but in the end, it is a both and understanding. In other words, we may be predisposed to trauma through our family line, you know, through our ancestors, but how we are nurtured or how we were nurtured does affect the degree to which intergenerational trauma can be triggered in us through unresolved trauma in our great-grandparents, grandparents, parents, so on and so forth. And the researcher, Hurley, I like the way he puts it, like silt deposited on the cogs of a finely tuned machine after the seaweed of a tsunami recedes. Our experiences and those of our forebears are never gone, even if they have been forgotten. They become part of us, a molecular residue holding fast to our genetic scaffolding. The DNA appears to remain the same, but psychological and behavioral tendencies are inherited. You might have inherited not just your grandmother's knobby knees, but also her predisposition towards depression caused by the neglect that she suffered as a newborn. And that's just one example. But in an article that was entitled, Can Trauma Be Passed On Through Our DNA? The author Davis states that the single most dangerous idea that he learned in school is that the genes that you get from your parents are passed on to your children, and nothing you do in your life changes them. Well, I tend to disagree with that. There is something we can do, okay? But we'll talk more about that later on in the show. And many people I talk to also believe that their physical traits and family illnesses and so forth cannot be changed. However, in challenging this notion, Davis states that although people do indeed pass on the exact same chromosomes from grandparent, parent to child, the quality of these chromosomes, when they are received, have the potential to be enhanced or diminished according to what happens to us and the choices we make during our lifetime. Okay, and this is the study of epigenetics, you know, upon the genes, as it were. What is it about the trauma that actually can change genes over time? And again, to what degree? But, you know, in a way, these studies tap into good old Pavlov's theory of classical conditioning. And just in case you forgot, you know, initially Pavlov was able to condition a dog's mouth-watering response, shall I say, to the smell of meat powder with the ringing of the bell. You know, every time Pablo rang the bell, he produced the meat powder, which in turn made the dog's mouth water. And eventually, the dog learned to associate hearing the bell with food. And this initial experiment led Pavlov to further understand how human beings are also conditioned by various experiences. And for example, let's say a person had a near-drowning experience, might become so conditioned to fear the sound of rushing water, or such as, you know, the crashing of ocean waves or the rapid torrent of a river. Now, the sound of such water may conjure up, you know, heightened anxiety, hypervigilance, a pounding heart rate, sensations of suffocation or tightness in one's chest, and so forth. And while there is an element of safety in the fear itself, especially if the person cannot swim in rushing water, fear becomes another matter altogether when these same physiological reactions are experienced when filling a bathtub with water. You see, the element of danger is reduced, yet in the mind and the body, it's reacting and it's shifting into a survival mode. And yet, are these self-preservation conditioned responses something we keep to ourselves? Or have they been passed down, you know, genetically to us from our ancestors, great-grandparents, grandparents, parents, and so forth? Well, there was this, actually a study done from the Department of Psychiatry at Emory University, and it suggests that such experiences are somehow transferred from the brain into our DNA, kind of like a fingerprint or a thumbprint, which not only changes the structure of the chromosome, but also conditions the genes to be passed on to later generations. Again, this is epigenetics. Okay, and from a translational perspective, our results allow us to appreciate how the experiences of a parent before even conceiving offspring, according to the Department of Psychiatry, their findings, it just is influenced by both structure and function in the nervous system of the subsequent generations. And such a phenomenon may contribute to the etiology and the potential intergenerational transmission of risk for such things as, you know, disorders such as phobias, anxiety, and post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. Now, another study was done by McCratty, and he writes that the heart, like the brain, generates a powerful electromagnetic field, which actually can be measured several feet away from a person's body and between two individuals in close proximity, okay? For example, how many times have you walked by somebody and you've just picked up a certain vibe that the person is giving off, or sitting near people who are expressively happy and you feel a certain lift in your emotions? And I'm sure everybody has at one time, whether or not we are paying attention to it. And, you know, But the same is also true within us. You know, without us realizing it, our cardio electromagnetic field gives off information, so to speak, when we are angry and fearful, depressed, or experiencing some other negative emotion, as well as when we are empathetic, when we have compassion or gratitude or love, when we experience something positive. So this is all studies that have come out of the Heart Math Institute. And there was one study that really caught my eye. It was just the heart-brain synchronization between a mother and baby. It studied the energetic heart-brain interactions that occur between a mother and her infant. And researchers, ironically, were able to show that the mother's brain waves synchronized to that of her baby's heartbeat. You see, it appears that when the mother placed her attention on the baby, that she became more sensitive to the subtle electromagnetic signals generated by the infant's heart. In other words, communication was going on all the time. And from these studies, there is strong evidence to suggest that our social interactions have the potential to not only affect family members, but all relationships. And so, you guessed it, the implications can also be applied to our ancestors through our soul connection. So again, this is something else to consider when we start looking at intergenerational trauma and how it's being passed down from generation to generation to generation. Well, back in 2016, a researcher by the name of Bernstein, he did a study that looked at how when a person has exposure to, let's say, war or severe stress or death or starvation, diseases, and so forth that occur prior to conception and in utero even, can have lasting effects on subsequent generations. And the example that he pulls up is there was a study done by some researchers during the Dutch famine of 1944-1945. This is during World War II. And although the Netherlands took a neutral stance in the war, at some point Hitler's troops invaded. And they took control of the country by, I think it was May 1940. And so to avoid capture, the Dutch government and the royal family fled to England. They were able to get out okay. And yet, despite the fact that by September 1944, the Allied troops had liberated most of the country in the south, unfortunately, their advances towards northern Netherlands were halted at the Waal and Rhine rivers at the Battle of Arnhem. And in support of the Allied war effort, the Dutch government in exile in London called for a national railway strike to hinder German military initiatives. So, in retaliation, in October 1944, the German authorities blocked all food supplies to the occupied west of the country. And so, this Hungerwinter, or hunger winter, as it has been described, was a time when food supplies became increasingly scarce. And for approximately 8 months, there was widespread starvation and infectious diseases of the digestive system that were seen especially among the populations in the cities of Western Netherlands. Now, interestingly enough, such trauma that was going on at the time also affected the reproductive outcomes of women who gave birth during this period. You know, their newborns who were exposed to this famine during gestation were reported to have lower birth weights, malformations, and increased perinatal mortality. And in addition, long-term developmental effects of the famine could be seen in increased physical and psychological effects of infants born during the famine. So again, in looking at intergenerational trauma, we could really see the transmission of this. But again, the arguments continue. Is it nature? Is it nurture? Is it what comes down through the genes, the DNA? Or is it how we were raised, the cultural impressions, and so forth? Yes, is the answer to that one. Both. To what degree is an ongoing debate. Well, I would really love to hear your heart on these matters. So again, if you would like to call in, that number is 800-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. There we go. And I'll be taking your calls after the break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I'm your host, Dr. James Houck, and I'll be back with you in 1 minute. Right, welcome back. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you're listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Just want to give you a heads up. 2 weeks from today, there'll be another broadcast here, Wednesday, March 29th at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Well, earlier in the show, I was talking about how the treatment for PTSD often involves telling a story from the point of view of taking a journey. And regardless of the many treatments used out there to treat PTSD, there's a desired outcome from the traumatic event that remains the same in all of them. There's a sense in having this reconnection to what was lost, or in other words, going back to the way life was before the traumatic event. And this is something that I'm convinced we want, because we want to go back to a time when we didn't feel pain, or we want to go back to earlier times in which things were so much nicer for us. Because when something traumatic happens to us, it really shatters our world. It has the potential to shatter our assumptions about the goodness that in the world, the goodness in ourselves, the goodness of others, even the goodness of God. Okay. But of course, personal safety in helping somebody with PTSD or working through other memories, even acutely, of what has happened to them, personal safety is still a primary concern for the traumatized person. You know, you don't want them reliving the event over and over and over again, but you want them to be able to tell their story. You know, because again, anything could be a trigger, you know, to and has the potential to create unsafe conditions. You know, just having that heightened sense of like a startle response or flashbacks or even nightmares. That's always something that needs to be taken into consideration. Now, a traumatized person may seek professional help in alleviating the above symptoms, you know, just very, very strong anxiety and so forth. And however, in conjunction with, you know, their personal safety, there is, you know, an overall treatment goal of helping the person reconnect with others in their interpersonal relationships. Okay, that's just, it's natural. We are social beings. You know, there's something that everybody has in common, regardless of one's culture or one's race or one's language and so forth. We have this desire to be in relationship with others, but perhaps due to the nature of the traumatic event, we may call that into question. You know, just how safe am I? Can I trust others again? Can I trust myself again? And so forth. Okay? Because reconnecting interpersonal relationships, you know, we always have to do that by examining our personal assumptions about a sense of control and power in our lives. You know, we thought that we were in control. We thought we took all the precautions. We thought we had power. And whatever the nature is of the traumatic event, again, that really can shatter those assumptions. As well as, you know, what do we do or how do we heal from the interpersonal relationships in which these issues of trust and safety and self-esteem and so forth that may have been shattered by that loss. Well, in his work, The Analysis of the Self, psychologist Heinz Kohut, he defines the self as a person's psychological being, which consists of sensations and feelings and thoughts and attitudes towards themselves and the world. Now, according to his model of self-psychology, Kohut understood our inability to overcome many issues in our lives as stemming from an underdeveloped sense of who we are. And that is key. I want to say that again. Kohut understood our inability to overcome many issues in our lives as coming from this underdeveloped sense of who we are. In other words, if we truly knew ourselves, we should be able to overcome many issues in our lives. We just simply don't know ourselves yet. We don't know what to do. We don't know what works and so forth. I mean, moreover, not only are we simply not aware of who we are, but perhaps we're not aware of what inner gifts and beauty and strengths we possess. You know, but external objects in our lives that have been substituted for what we really desire in relationships, you know, such as love, acceptance, peace, intimacy, nurturing, courage, being safe and being, you know, when we feel vulnerable and so forth. And yet, in order to develop a healthy sense of who we are, a healthy self, we're required to internalize the qualities of external objects in our lives. And this occurs at a very, very early age in our lives. You know, for example, let's say we grew up with a favorite stuffed animal or toy, and we learned the value of comfort and fun and companionship and so forth that this toy provided. And the reason why this object connected with us is because, you know, it meets an inner emotional and psychological need. However, although this is normal behavior in childhood, you know, as we mature, we internalize these qualities and now substitute this stuffed animal toy for more meaningful emotional, physical, and sexual intimacy in human relationships with others. So in other words, the stuffed animal or the toy serves a purpose in childhood. But as we get older, we transfer that to significant human relationships. And if we're unable to do this, we're always going to struggle to kind of reciprocate these human qualities in very meaningful, life-giving ways. Well, how many of you out there have seen the movie Ted, okay? It's definitely, you know, a more contemporary example of this struggle that people face in moving from an underdeveloped sense of self towards a healthy self. Okay. So TED came out in, I think it was like 2012, somewhere around there. And in this film, if you recall, John Bennett, a 35-year-old man-child, received his childhood wish in making his teddy bear, Ted, come to life. Now, growing up, Ted served as a great companion. He served as a confidant and unconditional love for John. Nothing wrong with that. Unfortunately, John never internalized these qualities that he received from Ted, which is the object, and thus he struggled to find meaning and peace and contentment in his relationships, namely with his girlfriend Lori, without Ted always being around. And so let's just transfer this over into like today's language, that many people also look at external objects in order to satisfy the inner stirrings of their soul. You know, whether these objects are there that provide pleasure, happiness, comfort, security, and peace, these things can never touch the cry of our soul consciousness that connects us with God. These objects are simply poor substitutes that on one level serve to meet our emotional and or physical needs. However, the reason why we cling to external objects is because on one level, they work. Okay? For example, alcohol is indeed a depressant. It calms the emotional anxiety and stress. Okay, nothing new here about that. Cocaine is a stimulant. And it boosts mental and physical energy. Sexual orgasm releases dopamine in the brain and provides a physiological sense of elation. And a lengthy workout releases endorphins and provides us with just a very nice analgesic feeling. Yet, on the other hand, if we truly want to understand ourselves as soul, who we truly are deep, 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 deep within, we must learn that these external objects always point us to connect with a higher consciousness that transcends the emotional, psychological, and physical realms. In fact, as we listen to the cry of our soul, we realize our deepest desire is to connect and reconnect to the pure sense of who we are. You know, hello, reclaiming authenticity. Here we go. You know, in fact, this cry of our soul is so powerful and so deafening that once we fully embrace ourselves, we'll never be satisfied with anything less. You see, with self-psychology, Kohut understood our inability to overcome many issues, as I said, in our lives as stemming from an underdeveloped sense of who we are. Okay, so let's see. As stated earlier, any kind of trauma has the potential to one degree or another to disconnect us from who we are as a soul. And the reason for this is because trauma places a distorted template over our perceptions. So trauma says to us, well, that's all there is. And this is all there is to you, and this is as good as it's going to get. They're all lies and distortions that come from perhaps other wounded people who have yet to embrace themselves as a soul. However, once we embrace ourselves as a soul, we may be astonished to see the power of our soul to not only transcend trauma and transform our wounded energy, but I guarantee you, you're going to empower others to do the same. And yet still, as history teaches us, many have feared the resiliency and power of the soul, and therefore have tried to silence its cry. Like, good luck with that. Yeah, how are you going to silence the power of the soul? Then there's been killings and murders and genocide and starvations and forced assimilations and humiliations, degradations, looking at people as savages and or looking at them as primitive, backward, unworthy, unlovable, and therefore disposable, as those who think that they're in control see fit. But, you know, what is heartbreaking to me is that all these atrocities down through history have often, not all of them, most, have been committed in the name of God by people who should see themselves as souls. In fact, even when killing is done in the name of God, the only thing that is truly advanced is this distorted view that comes from those who will do anything to hang on to their power. Who told you that you're not a soul? Who told you that this is as good as your life is going to get? Who told you that, well, that's just all there is? Lies. Speaking of stories, I'm going to share with you just a pretty nice story I've really come to cherish over the past couple of years that really explains this template quite well. And interestingly enough, I had to go to India to hear this story. And I just said, I'm going to hang on to that. It's definitely a keeper. So once upon a time, there was a man who lived hundreds of years ago. And being a simple man, his occupation was that of a washer or a washerman, you know, one who goes around and he collects people's dirty laundry and he loads them on his donkey. And then he takes them down to the river and he washes the laundry, then lays them out, you know, on large rocks to dry. And then he folds the laundry and returns it to his customers. And he does this day in and day out without fail. Well, one day when he was collecting the laundry and taking it down to the river to wash them, he realized that he had forgotten the rope to which he would tie the donkey to a tree so that it wouldn't run off while he was washing the laundry. And he was so beside himself because now he would lose a whole day's wage if he had to go back at home to get his rope. He just didn't know what to do. And as he was standing there, not knowing what to do, a man walked by and asked if, you know, is everything okay? Are you all right? And the washerman explained the situation to this man about forgetting the rope so he couldn't tie his donkey and he's going to lose a day's wage if he has to go back to get the rope. Now it's just way too late. And this other man smiled and just said, sir, you don't need to worry. I have an idea. Just pretend to tie the donkey to this tree. Just pretend? Yeah. Just pretend to go through the motions of tying your donkey to this tree, only make sure he sees you do this. Well, as ridiculous as it sounded, the washerman did just that. He pretended to tie his donkey to the tree, making sure the donkey was watching him. And then he took his laundry down to the river and he began to wash. And every now and then, this washerman would look back over his shoulder back at the tree just to see what the donkey was doing. The donkey was still there, you know, minding its own business, eating grass and acting as if it is tied to the tree, perfectly content. And when the washerman finished with his laundry for the day, he loaded up his donkey with the now clean clothes, and he commanded the donkey to move. But the donkey did not move. It had acted as if it had been tied to the tree all along. Now, the washerman thought he was really in a bind now because, now I can't get my donkey to move. What am I going to do? So he runs and he finds this man who told him to pretend tying the donkey to the tree in the first place. And he eventually found this man and he explained the situation that now the donkey refuses to move because it thinks it's still tied to the tree. And the man replied to the washerman that, well, this is just another easy solution, sir. Just as you pretended to tie the donkey to the tree, now you need to pretend to untie the donkey from the tree. Only make sure the donkey watches you do this. So again, just thought it was ridiculous, you know, but okay, I'll do it. So the washerman goes back to the donkey and starts to pretend he's untying this donkey, and he made sure the donkey was watching him. Then, with a stern voice, he commanded the donkey to move, and he and the donkey started to walk back home. Now, cute story, but as with all great stories, you know, there's always a moral. There's a lesson. There's something for us to take away from it. So, like that donkey, humanity thinks it's in this kind of servitude or bondage. In other words, humanity doesn't know that we're not the body. We're not the mind, we're the, you know, or the intellect. We're independent of those things when you get right down to it. There are no restrictions on you. There's no bondages. And so even if the body dies, we're not going to die. And in the Hindi scriptures, the Vedanta, it tells humanity that the body and the soul are different. I mean, we're so limited in our understanding that we are bound by what we see and feel and hear and taste and touch that we think that's all there is. And so we, like the donkey, end up believing the illusion that we are limited or restricted simply because we were told by another that we are. Unfortunately, we take that on as our identity, and we act accordingly, believing that, well, this is as good as it's going to get. Really? Who told you that? Who told you that you were tied to the tree? You know, and I see this quite a bit in counseling people who have so identified themselves with their problems and their illnesses or even traumatic events that have, you know, that they've experienced. They're not aware of being more than what they have become so far in life. So they often accept this distorted template that has been laid over top their lives. And as a result, people tend to beat themselves up for making the same mistakes over and over and over again in the choices and relationships and throughout life. But, you know, we have to believe that we hold the key to our freedom. In fact, we're never tied to that tree. But many people search for the key, so to speak, in all the wrong places. That perhaps it just means I need to make more money. Or perhaps I just need to have more passion in my life, or a true love, or any other desire. But what if we are already free? What if there's no rope, no tree? What if the illusion of being in prison is simply an illusion? Now, I don't want to come across as one who minimizes another person's pain, by no means. I don't want to be one who comes across who minimizes another person's problems or struggles. But just entertain this for a second. How might we be empowered if we saw ourselves as the solutions to our problems by removing the layers of conditioning or the imaginary ropes that keep us tied to our problems? What keeps us bound to toxic relationships? What keeps us thinking that there's nothing more to us because we've been told this about ourselves all of our lives? Like I said, I had to go to India to hear this story, and I'm glad I did. It was definitely worth the trip. But had many discussions since then with my India friends, and you know, they are often just very, very passionate about this. You know, who is tying you to the tree? And my Indian friends understand that people are already in a relationship with all things and all people, including God, but they just don't know it yet. Therefore, it really comes down to it's a matter of realizing that we are souls, that we are vast, that we are formless. In fact, I've talked with my friends in India, and we've had some pretty interesting conversations about sin and ignorance. And whereas others see sin as people, you know, are being, you know, bad or evil, they believe that people act out of their ignorance of who they are. And therefore, yes, they're going to commit evil acts because they have not realized themselves as souls. They have not realized others as souls. And in Western spirituality, the concept of sin tells people that, you know, are wrong or have some, they've done something wrong, and therefore you need to eliminate the sin in order to be in a right relationship with God and others. And, you know, and for us, regardless of religion, it's a matter of understanding how we live our lives with superimposed notions or distorted templates. We have bodies and we have minds, but do we need to believe that that's all there is to us? And that hopefully one day we get to go to heaven. I've even seen this in Christianity, that people are afraid to walk in the newness of life, so to speak, because they still believe they're tied to this tree because somebody told them they were tied to the tree. And this is what it means, I'm convinced, this is what it means to move into a higher spiritual dimensional relationship with God. And yes, we have to contend with living in a 3D world, but we're so limited where all we have to do is realize our freedom. I mean, didn't Christ say at one point that the kingdom of God is within you? We just haven't realized it yet. Perhaps we just don't know how to embrace it, let alone walk in the newness of that life and relationship. But what a difference it would make in our lives and the lives of humanity in general if we see the illusion for what it is and we untie the limitations of this donkey mind, dissolve the ignorance of who we are, and walk in the freedom that has always been with us. I imagine that the world would be radically different. Healing is a matter of unlearning these intergenerational traumatic experiences and learning the lessons that have affected what family members have believed about themselves, as well as how these perceptions have affected the behaviors towards one another. And even if one's parents and grandparents are deceased, healing can still be achieved by understanding the dynamics of trauma that has been handed down in the family, as well as appreciating the resiliency and other character strengths that the family members have also possessed and handed down. You see, the emotional and psychological wounds are not the only thing that we may have inherited, but we certainly may have inherited our character strengths, our gifts, and our skills were also handed down. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you have been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Thank you for sharing this hour with me. And again, invite you in 2 weeks to tune in to Wednesday, March 29th at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for another broadcast of Reclaiming Authenticity. So in the meantime, may everybody have a safe St. Patrick's Day. Enjoy the first day of spring. Behave yourselves. And may God hold each and every one of us in the palm of God's hands. Take care.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding around to buy a book by Dr. Hauk. It's all there. Just wander over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 6 p.m. Pacific, on BBS Radio TV.